Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Despite our best laid plans, life can often be difficult, disappointing, and stressful. Consequently, when things don't go right, we are often left in a state of emotional chaos, dealing with feelings like anger, anxiety, frustration, and doubt, which can cloud our perspective and negatively affect the way we live our lives. But we need not be at the mercy of our emotions. Today's guest shows us that it is possible to achieve a state of emotional clarity that allows us to live skillfully and act with wisdom even in the face of obstacles. Our guest on Pathways today is Philip Moffitt, author of the new book, Emotional Chaos to Clarity: How to Live More Skillfully, Make Better Decisions, and Find Purpose in Life. The former Esquire magazine CEO and editor-in-chief, Philip left his successful publishing career at the age of 40 to embark on a path that led him to become a Buddhist meditation teacher and found the Life Balance Institute, where he trains executives and individuals in skillful living. He is a teacher at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California and the author of another book, Dancing with Life: Buddhist Insights for Finding Meaning and Joy in Everyday Life. This is Philip's second time as a guest on Pathways. Hello, Philip, and welcome back to the Pathways program.
Hello, Paul. It's nice to be back.
Now, before we get into your new book, Emotional Chaos to Clarity, why don't you please relate to our listeners the story of how and why you walked away from your position as CEO and editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine to more fully pursue meditation and Buddhism?
Well, I made the decision to leave Esquire at age 40, which was a little early to be going off to explore the inner life, because typically that's associated much more with what someone does in their 50s or 60s. But I had been of this nature since my 20s. I started my first company at age 20, a magazine company for college students. And at that time, I already had this interest, but what is the inner experience rather than the outer experience? So with the outer experience, you're accomplishing something in the world, or you're establishing relationships and so forth. But what is the inner experience, and where does the meaning really lie, in the outer or the inner, or some balance of those? And I explored this throughout my 20s. I was quite an intensive Raja Yoga practitioner, which involves a lot of meditation experience, as well as the pasanas and the asanas and the regular things that one associates with yoga. And then in my 30s, I discovered Theravadan Buddhism, and that just sort of completed the process. So I was actually ready to leave by the age of 36, but I couldn't quite get myself to step out the door. Very hard to leave the goodies of the world, and I had a lot of them.
So tell us about the debate that might have gone on in your mind in order to make that decision.
Well, the first thing is I would say to people I respected, you know, I'm thinking of selling the magazine and spending the rest of my life in meditation and exploring the inner life. And they would look at me like, are you crazy? And they would say with such sincerity, well, Philip, you can just put other people in charge of things and you can have your cake and eat it too. And I'd go, yeah, maybe I am off base here, and maybe I can have my cake and eat it too. And all I can say is that I, for one person, could not have my cake and eat it too, because I feel such responsibility if I'm responsible for something that I can't say, oh, well, somebody else will take care of that. If I'm in charge, then I'm in charge, and I take real responsibility.
So would you say that this is a principle that applies in general to people, that you can't really have your cake and eat it too, that you have to give something up for something better?
What I have found, because I've worked with lots of leaders now, I mean, a really wide range of leaders, including a number that your listeners would know from reading the newspaper or hearing things on television. And what I have seen is that it is possible to have a balanced life once you have achieved a certain level of success in the area in which you are specialized, so that you're not constantly scrambling. And it has to be an area where there is some degree of stability in what you're doing. Because like in the magazine business, at any moment, a magazine can go downhill, it can turn on you. So it needed constant attention. So there was not really a way to have that kind of balance in my
situation. To mention the constant deadlines of a business.
Always deadlines. Deadlines after deadlines.
Now, as a teacher, my understanding is that your perspective is grounded in both Western psychology and Buddhist philosophy.
Correct. I was very influenced by C.G. Jung's work and some of the modern practitioners of the analytical psychology that he introduced. And, of course, most influenced by the Theravadan Buddhism.
Now, 4 years ago, we talked about your first book, Dancing with Life, which contained insights for finding meaning and joy in life. How does your new book add to that understanding?
Well, I actually come off of this experience with Dancing with Life, in which as I traveled around the country teaching the insights from Dancing with Life, people would ask me over and over again, well, okay, so how do I actually go live this day to day in my life? And that was a very good question, but that wasn't what I was doing in the Dancing with Life book. And so gradually, I started taking pieces of what I ended up teaching people and collecting them to write about them, and that became the basis for Emotional Chaos to Clarity.
And how did you come up with this phrase, emotional chaos? Was that something that just kept coming up?
People would talk about the consternation they would have, or the confusion, or the uncertainty, or this sense of, well, I don't know what I'm about, or I've disappointed myself, I'm so angry at me, or I'm so angry at this other person, and all of these very strong emotions. And now in Buddhism, we would refer to that as dukkha, or suffering. But that doesn't really help people who are not Buddhist to understand it. And so emotional chaos is something that everybody can understand. And this book, Emotional Chaos to Clarity, is for everyone.
And so what is the cause of emotional chaos and how does it arise?
Emotional chaos comes about because of our relationship to an experience we're having. So let's suppose that someone has treated you unfairly. That hurts. It hurts. And out of that hurt, you can get angry, you can get defeated, you can turn on yourself, you can sort of give up on yourself. All of these different kinds of emotional experiences can arise. And what I am pointing to is not how to avoid people hurting you. People are going to let you down. They're going to be unfair to you. It's all part of life. But where there is a choice is in your relationship to how you respond when someone does something that is not fair to you.
Now, you make a distinction between reacting and responding that I found very interesting.
Reactive mind is when you identify with your experience, whether the experience is a positive experience, like, oh, I'm so glad I have this, and you go, oh, I'm glad I've got this, I want to have more of it, I don't want to lose it. So you get so identified with it that you actually get lost in it, just as you can get lost in your anger or your disappointment or your confusion. Anytime that you over-identify with the experience you're having in your mind from any of the sense gates, when you over-identify, that is a reactive mind. You become like a puppet on the strings of pleasant and unpleasant, and how you feel about the pleasantness of it or the unpleasant.
So ultimately, it doesn't really matter whether it's an attraction or an aversion.
That's correct.
Either way, it's a reaction.
Either way, it's a reaction. And either way, you're going to get caught. And there's going to be this dissatisfaction to a cold disaster of behavior and speech on your part.
Now, this emotional chaos that you write about, do you feel this is more of a problem now than it has been in the past?
As people become more individual in making their decisions, and the group and so forth, the group and their family and all don't dictate their behavior, and they feel more, there's actually more burden on them to make their own decisions and find their own peace or own happiness in life. Yes, it's more so. So if you go back to the reactivity of the mind, what's the opposite of reacting to your immediately identifying with it? It's what I call responsive mind. And in responsive mind, you go, oh, this has arisen in my mind. Oh, I'm excited, and I'm really wanting more of this. And, oh, I'm a little nervous about not getting credit for this. Or there's this anger, or there's this confusion, or this loneliness. And so you recognize through mindfulness that this is what's arising in your mind, and then you choose based on your values, what I call your intention, to you choose and how you're going to respond, how you're going to relate to this particular thing that's arising in your mind. And people are shocked at how quickly they can start to make this distinction and start to have some minimal degree of choice.
So what are some of the more common self-defeating habits of mind?
Well, the first one is this feeling, and this surprises people when I say this, this feeling of your own limitation. It is shocking to me how more willing we are to identify and own, admit to our limitations than we are willing to admit to the possibility of being larger than we have lived.
Now, how is this related to what you write about freeing ourselves from the past?
This is one way that we get caught. We get defined by our past. We become an identity based on our past. Well, I've had this terrible thing happen to me, or this has been the nature of my life, or these are my duties and responsibilities. And we start to form an identity that is actually a very limited identity. And we see the world just from this very small part of this much larger experience that we have.
In what role does self-knowledge play in this process?
Self-knowledge is, again, gained through the mindfulness, through our direct experience of watching us and our experience, not some philosophy or something someone else has told you, but being present for your own experience and seeing what it's really like. And this self-knowledge, this awareness of the experience that you're having, is when you start to realize, I want a better choice than this. I don't want this to be all there is to life. I don't want this to be all there is to my emotional experience. I want to have more choice. Is it possible that I, with all my limitations, might have more choice? And that begins the inquiry.
Right. So self-knowledge derives from mindfulness.
From mindfulness.
And this mindfulness, this is a word that keeps coming up. It's gaining traction in the vernacular. Would you define it for us?
Yes. Mindfulness is the accept being aware of what's present in the moment with an accepting attitude that's non-objecting, so that it registers and you stay with it. Now, let's suppose you're aware that your back's hurting. You may, in a few seconds, move your posture to see if that relieves the pain in the back, but you don't get reactive to the back pain first. First you just go, oh, my back's hurting. Or, oh, I'm in this meeting and I'm feeling insecure in this meeting. And so feeling insecure feels like this. This is the registering of your experience to yourself. And one side benefit, by the way, is once you start living this way, is you feel so much more authentic to yourself. You feel genuine to yourself.
So it has a lot to do with self-acceptance.
Yes. Well, with self-acceptance and a willingness to live out yourself in this way, indeed.
Now, I like the way that you say that we need not be at the mercy of our emotions.
Correct.
That's such a hopeful message that this book is really all about. And one of the chapters is entitled Ending the Cycle of Self-Violence. And I thought that was very interesting, the way that you defined self-violence.
Self-violence is the way that we treat ourselves in regard to how we schedule our time, what responsibilities we take on, our inner way of speaking to ourselves. There's a number of different things that can be part of self-violence. In our society, what is widespread is the overscheduling of ourselves. We overschedule even our leisure time so that there is actually no sense of actual leisure. Well, I've got to get to this, now I've got to get to that.
Right.
And so the nervous system isn't really getting to recover from our work lives.
You know, you have the quote from Thomas Merton in the book that I thought was really incredible on this subject of self-violence, where he says, "To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is itself to succumb to the violence of our times."
Isn't that amazing?
Well, we sure live in violent times.
Mach said that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and this the speed of our lives as we try to do that adds to the reactivity, and that's why we become a slave to our emotions. We have no space to adjust, to ground ourselves, to relax, to let go. Someone asked me just yesterday about dealing with a very emotional situation in their lives, and they were having all these different emotions. Something had come up that was really scary for them, and they felt a little mistreated by it, and had a lot of different emotions. And they were saying, I'm trying to get past those emotions. And I said, instead of trying to get past those emotions, give them a big pasture in which to roam. They will calm down on their own if you give them a big pasture. They're like horses that have gotten spooked. They've got to run around for a moment, and they'll run around for a while, and they'll settle down. But if you try to do something to them, now you've added one more activity, and your sense of failure around this is going to add another emotion of failure.
Right. So in other words, you're reacting to your reaction.
That's right. One of the things that I teach on retreat, I ask people to take three vows. This is a silent meditation retreat of some days. I will say, are you willing to take the vow of giving up self-judgment, that I will not have judging mind for the length of this retreat? Mm-hmm. And people are sort of startled by that. And then during the retreat, they report how much they have to struggle to not use that self-judging language. And then I will say, are you willing to give up comparing mind? And they're supposed to say, I renounce comparing mind.
Uh-huh.
And again, they're shocked at how much of their time they are spending in comparing mind. And then the third one, and this goes back to the violence against self, is fixing mind. And they vow to renounce fixing mind. And if you start to look at yourself, you see how much of your day is spent either saying something inside to yourself or saying it to another person that's either judging, comparing, or fixing. So we look at our experience and from these three lenses, and they're very limiting, and they add to this reactivity of mind.
Now, you take a term like self-violence, and this is a very unattractive term. Nobody wants to think that they're being violent towards themselves. Do you think it's useful in a meditation practice to plunk labels like that onto these kinds of states of mind? I remember when I was learning Vipassana, and I would have these feelings of disgust for myself because I couldn't keep from daydreaming for more than 20 minutes, and I thought, oh, this is terrible, and then I'd get angry at myself, and I talked to my teacher, and I came up with a label for that, which I called self-hatred. Well, I don't want, you know, self-criticism sounds like it might almost be good, but self-hatred is obviously not bad. Do you think that's a good idea?
It depends on the person and their personality.
Uh-huh.
Because one person, certain words are so charged, or a certain labeling negative would be too much, and for someone else, it would be the most useful thing, as it was in your case. The thing about non-judging, non-comparing, and non-fixing is those are not making a you. Those are activities of mind. And once you start to notice the activities of mind, you're already moving away from this identifying with. And you see, this is one of these hidden benefits. Oh, this is judging mind right now. It's just judging mind right now.
Yeah.
It's not me.
Yeah. It's just a phenomenon.
It's just a phenomenon. And the mindfulness that is taught in the Vipassana meditation system is built on the verbs of life, not the nouns of life.
Right, right. Now, I find it fascinating that you make the point in the book that we have an instinct for self-restraint. I mean, it sure doesn't seem like self-restraint is very natural.
It doesn't at times because we get so swept away by our emotions. But had we not an instinct for self-restraint, we would have extinguished ourselves on the savanna of all of those tens of thousands of years ago when we were hunters and gatherers. Because without self-constraint, you cannot have cooperation. And also, this propensity we have for self-reflection involves self-restraint, and also our willingness to sacrifice for others all involves self-restraint.
And the self-restraint that you write about in the book involves some very interesting renunciations.
Indeed.
Can you share that?
Yes. Well, again, I will do this on even a day-long retreat. People will say, well, I'm never going to be like a monk or a nun, and how does all of this work if you want to live a spiritual life? And I talk about the necessity of some sort of of renunciation, some sort of self-restraint, where you learn some sort of self-discipline, and I suggest three of them. The first that I suggest is that you give up measuring the success of your life by how many of your desires are met. And that's what most of us do, even though that's not really a very satisfying experience, because what we notice when we're measuring by how many of our desires are met by the success of our life, we then end up emphasizing what we don't have. Right. So we're actually constantly finding ourselves falling short. Even very successful people have sat in my office and lamented out of the ways that they've fallen short, and with no appreciation or gratitude, no balance in terms of all of the things that have worked so well for them. So that's the first one. And then the second one I teach is renouncing being the star of your own movie. And this always gets a bunch of laughs, because we are all in our own movie. And without examining it, we act as though we're the star of the movie, that everything that happens to us was all about us. But most of the things that happen to us is because other people are doing other thing, and life is doing itself. It's raining outside, there's traffic, it was too busy, you couldn't get through on the phone line. All of these things are just happening, and it's not really about us. And when we cease being the star of our own movie, then we take responsibility for being in the movie, but we don't feel that pressure that leads to the reactive mind. We don't get enslaved by those emotions in the same way. And it's fun to not be the star of your own movie.
Yeah, it's a relief, probably.
Oh, it's such a relief. I've had many, many people report that, because that's the one that people are most drawn to of the three. And then the third one that we come across is this possibility,
self-righteousness,
the possibility of letting loose of our attachment to being right. And this was the hard one for me, because I was a fix-it type. I wasn't a judging and comparing type, but I wanted to fix things. And so if you're going to fix things, you have to have a sense of, oh, this is what it's needed, and this need to be right. And I've often encountered people who will confess to me that they would rather be right than get their way. That the sense of I'm right, they are addicted to. That they look around for ways to be right. That they position how they even speak to be right. And this may be in relation to their partner, their relationship, or it may be at work, or it may be throughout their life, that they want to be right, and they will notice things of that happen and say, well, that proves I'm right. And even though they can look back later and go, that wasn't proving that at all.
And in the meantime, they've alienated people.
Yes. And they've also, again, narrowed their options. This desire to be right, this need to be right, and you use that term self-righteous. And out of that need to be right, there often develops this entitlement of, because I'm right and you didn't listen to me, now I'm entitled to my emotions. They didn't listen to me, or my partner didn't listen to me, and we get entitled to these emotions that are destructive emotions, and we're back into the emotional chaos.
Another fascinating concept in the book that seemed counterintuitive to me was this idea of overcoming ordinary compulsiveness.
Overcoming ordinary compulsiveness.
What is ordinary compulsiveness?
Well, first of all, there's a kind of compulsiveness that is a mental illness that is not what we're talking
right.
about, but rather it's the kind of compulsion that we each have to check our email constantly. That may be a compulsion for you. The compulsion to constantly flick the TV channels, the compulsion around eating, the compulsion around drawing attention to ourselves, or a thousand other possibilities. And many people, when they start looking at this, see how much of their day they are being motivated by one kind of ordinary compulsion or another, and that they really don't have choice. And the value of clarity, this emotional chaos to clarity, clarity brings choice. And when we become clear about how often we're imprisoned by our compulsiveness, we see that we don't want to keep this up, and we gradually start to break free of that. It is everywhere. The way we speak to certain people, there's a compulsiveness, the way maybe you've got a difficult brother or sister. You speak to that person
right.
out of a compulsiveness. You really not have any choice.
How did you know? You know, one of the things that's really sweet in the book is this concept of learning how to soothe ourselves when we feel disappointed or overwhelmed.
Yes, I call that self-soothing. And self-soothing is an art that we should all learn. And this ability to self-soothe starts with being able to ground yourself. Well, what am I really about here? The mindfulness becomes a compassionate mindfulness. This is really hard. Being treated this way hurts. Or I'm not sure I'm going to be able to pull this off. I am scared. And so the recognition of what's in your mind, what's in your heart right now, is received with compassion, compassionate mindfulness. And then when something doesn't work out, to be able to use mindfulness, to use intention, to be a kind of ability to reassure yourself that is not indulgent, by the way, and it's not particularly emotional, and it's certainly not sentimental. It is the kind of self-soothing that you would do with an animal, that you would do with a child. It is coming back to yourself. It's very practical.
You know, I like when you recommend that we can realize the imaginative potential of our lives. And you point out that the Buddha said the future is always other than you imagine it.
Yes. Well, and I call that to imagine the future potential as the imaginative possible. And the imaginative possible is that moment when we're considering doing something that we've been working at trying to do, that we realize for ourselves we truly know. In Buddhism, it's called directly knowing or intuitively knowing that this might be possible. So say you're learning a foreign language, and you know you've struggled, and then you suddenly realize, I might really be able to do this. This is the same with matters of heart, matters of your head, and of skill sets.
Well, we've just about run out of time, which is amazing, because we could go on for a lot longer than this. But before we quit, tell us about the book's website.
EmotionalChaosToClarity.org offers a study guide for those who would like to have a little group or study this with a friend. But best of all, it offers a 52-week lesson that you can sign up on the website, EmotionalChaosToClarity.org, and get this lesson every week free. You just go to the website, sign up, and it's a little small piece from the book with a little bit of a reflection that helps you work with your own clarity.
So it's a nice companion to the book. And I know there's exercises in the book, too, that we didn't have time to talk about. So that's EmotionalChaosToClarity.org. All one word, EmotionalChaosToClarity.
Correct.
Well, we have run out of time, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Really appreciate it.
It's always fun to be with you.
And for those who tuned in late, this is Paul O'Brien, and you can replay the entire interview anytime you want via the internet at divination.com or kboo.fm. Today we have been visiting Philip Moffitt, author of the new book, Emotional Chaos to Clarity. To our listeners, I want to say thank you for tuning in to Pathways, which is made possible in part by a grant from the Divination Foundation, information at divination.com. That's divination.com. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcasts, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks again for tuning in and being a part of it.